Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by the Coalition of Cartoon Anvils. We're not nearly as violent as the media portrays us. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. With me is James. Last week we did part one of our Fincher podcast where we discussed Seven, Alien 3 a little bit, The Game, Fight Club a little bit, Panic Room, and Zodiac. We were very productive last week. Yeah. And we're going to continue on that discussion about David Fincher.
What?
Yeah.
You told me this was going to be about Serial Joe.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You can put all of your signed paraphernalia from Serial Joe away. We are not going to be talking about it today.
I can't remove this tattoo.
Well, that's a good point.
David Fincher, part two.
Yeah, let's do this.
Let's do it. Finch Man.
Okay, so Zodiac was the last movie we talked about, and then he moved on to The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Benjaboo!
Yep. That's not going to peak in the audio. It's not going to piss people off. So yeah, the Benjamin Button is about, well, Benjamin Button.
Benjamin Button is about Forrest Gump.
I disagree. Okay. It's about a guy who ages backwards, and that's sort of the concept of the movie. Some people see it as a love story because there is a defined woman that he is supposed to be in love with the whole time, he is occasionally in love with, but knows for the whole movie pretty much.
Yeah.
He's born an old man and sort of aging backwards, but he's born like old man baby and then sort of grows into a legit old man and then starts aging backwards and
shrinks again.
Yeah, and the idea is at the end of the movie he's a baby and he dies, you know. But after living like 80 years or something.
With a whole exciting life.
Yeah.
And based on F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story.
Yep, that's true.
And directed by David Fincher.
Yes.
Starring Brad Pitt as
Benjamin Button. Yeah. And starring Cate Blanchett as Daisy. It's just, I don't know. What do you think about Benjamin Button?
The man or the movie?
The film.
Oh, I guess that's true. The film is good. I like it.
Okay.
I think it is entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is interesting. I think the concept, I mean, just the short story, it's a cool concept. Mm-hmm. And I would have been disappointed if this movie wasn't good. Not because I had seen, not because I had read the story, but it's such a cool concept that there's so much to do with it. And I think that they do a good job of playing with the theme of time and relationships and timing and things like that.
Yep.
And I don't really care for the love story that much. I don't think you do either.
Nope.
But I think it says some interesting stuff about relationships without actually nailing the relationship part that well. And I think it's cool. And lots of stuff happens. And I think it's a lot like Forrest Gump, but not to a fault.
I suppose, it's not hard to see the similarities to Forrest Gump, but I mean, I don't want this to turn into a comparison. I think Benjamin Button's just a more interesting movie than Forrest Gump. I really don't like Forrest Gump for our listeners.
I know you don't. And I think Forrest Gump's more about America, or also a lot about America, whereas Benjamin Button's about people.
Yeah, and that's why I find it more interesting.
Yeah, I figured you would.
I'm more interested in people than America. I think the problem with, because this is not a particularly well-liked movie, I don't think.
It's divisive.
This is sort of a movie that critics liked, but I think a lot of them, looking at reviews for the movie, I always sort of was like, they're focusing on the wrong thing. There's no way they actually liked that aspect of the movie. And I think part of the reason, and I mentioned this for Fight Club, I feel like part of Fight Club's reception problems was how it was sold, is that they really seem to see Benjamin Button as a love story, which I don't think it is at all. I think there is a love aspect, but it's about Benjamin Button's life, and there are a number of people that he loves in this movie. It just so happens that since Daisy was also on the poster, it's sort of like, oh, it's this everlasting love story, which it's not.
And her face is like 40% of that poster.
Yeah. Well, and Benjamin Button's the other
40, and then there's 20% black in words. But no, I know I'm agreeing with you. I think that they were like, look, this is about a romance, and yeah, it's more about how life works for all of us, even as looked through the lens of this unique case of someone who ages backwards, which none of us do.
Yeah, and all the aging backwards thing is supposed to do is sort of point out how important how timing is when we, as far as timing as to when he meets people. And I mean, I wrote about this back in July probably. And yeah, Benjamin Button is about Benjamin Button, unsurprisingly, because his name is in the title, and it's about the people he meets over the course of his whole life. And the idea is, this is a movie about a whole life, and it points out how many people really make a good impact on you as a person. And that number is fairly small. Like, you know, you get his adoptive mother, Queenie, the woman who teaches him how to play piano, whose name he doesn't even remember, which I really like.
Yeah.
The captain, played by Jared Harris, Daisy, of course.
Lieutenant Dan.
Yeah. The idea is there are parts of this movie when Daisy and Benjamin, who meet when Daisy's very young, and when they meet up again, they're points where Benjamin kind of hates Daisy. There's that dinner where Daisy just goes on and on about how she's a dancer and monologuing, and Benjamin's just sitting there chilling, eating his caviar.
Did not make you like Kate Blanchett anymore.
She's an unlikable character for most of the movie. And the point that proves the thing that this is not a love story is that the times when they are the most in love is told in a 3-minute montage to Twist and Shout. This movie doesn't show them in love. It just shows the important things that happened in their life and that they were at one point in love.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting, and the idea of all these people that, you know, if he meets them at a different time, then he's not friends with them. Like if he meets Jared Harris's character, the boat captain, Lieutenant Dan, as you want to call him, if he meets him like 20 years later, I doubt he goes on the boat, you know?
Yeah.
And it's that type of thing. And I mean, even people like us that age forwards, that type of thing happens constantly. Like there's clearly somebody, you know, and everybody's life that maybe they would have dated if they met 3 years earlier or 3 years after or something. It's just sort of these circumstances. And
that could be good or bad.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing in the movie, and I mean, I'm monologuing, but I think this is my last point. There's that bit with Daisy's accident about halfway, 75% through the movie, where they sort of run down all of these things that had to happen for Daisy to get hit by a car, like a cabbie stopping to have a coffee or
a shoelace breaking,
someone breaking up with their boyfriend, like all of these things that as a whole are trivial. And this is also something How I Met Your Mother does a lot, which I like, but I like a lot about that show. But and it's just, if any of these one things happens, then Daisy maybe doesn't get hit by a car. Maybe she sort of just dances across the street and nothing bad happens. But life being what it is, an intersecting series of lives and circumstances or something is what Benjamin does. She gets hit. What? You don't like it?
No. Her just dancing out into the middle of the street, you're begging to be hit by a car.
Yeah.
I agree with your point, but
Have you not seen someone do something stupid in the middle of the street? You know, like.
Yeah, but again,
I've seen you do stupid things in the middle of the street. These things happen.
I know. It just doesn't make me like her anymore or have sympathy for her.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We've covered this. Just
I know.
Okay, fine. We'll never talk about Cate Blanchett again in this movie. But
I think there's been movies or scenes in movies and entire movies that really play with that concept about everything. Like, I guess the butterfly effect and what was that? Sliding Doors?
Yep.
But you know, just this one small change can have huge impact on you. But I thought that scene was done well, and I like that part of the movie.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting part, and it's a very interesting movie. Yeah, I just like it a lot. I mean, there are things I don't like. I don't like Brad Pitt in it.
I like Brad Pitt in it.
Yeah, because you like Brad Pitt a lot. Yeah,
I enjoy him in this. He's kind of got he's like a nicer Jesse James at parts too.
Fine, sure. I think he's a good actor sometimes. Like, I really like the part where he's waiting to find out if his baby's healthy in this movie, and he's just sort of pacing around. I think that's good Brad Pitt acting.
I like him when he's old.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff early on.
The majority of that is not his body, though.
Yeah, I know, but I think it's good.
Okay.
I guess we could talk about the makeup in this, or the visual effects, like the makeup and the CGI and all the stuff they do for his aging stuff.
Hmm.
It won some Academy Awards. I think it got best makeup and best visual, some other best visual thing.
Okay.
And I think best costume or something similar.
Okay.
And it totally deserves it. I think the visuals are awesome in this. You don't like the aging? You don't think it's done well?
I think it's done as well as it could have been. I mean,
Well, what more do you want?
Well, there's a lot of...
You want more than as well as it could have been done?
No, but I'm not going to call it flawless. Like, it's... I don't know. There are, I think, technical issues with this movie. Like
what? I think the hummingbird, but that's not...
No, that's fine. There are some CGI moments, like with the whole aging thing, that just don't work for me. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. But if you want to watch the movie, you know, and I'll point out shots that I don't like. There are a number of them.
Oh, I liked it.
And in general, yeah, I did like it, and I do like this movie. I just think that the actual makeup and, you know, the effects are the least interesting part of this movie.
I thought that was really well done.
Yeah.
This is a $150 million movie.
Yeah, that's that makeup stuff that you love.
I know, that's just so much money for like a... I mean, I know it's an epic, but it is still a drama. Are there other...
But a movie that you can push for like sort of a prestige type of thing, which this was, and it was pushed as such, and it had a teaser trailer, I think, in front of Iron Man that was a very good, engaging teaser trailer. It used like the music from the beginning of Days of Heaven, and it really sold me on the movie even before... Well, I knew Fincher was directing this, but I would have been sold on that movie without Fincher's name.
Yeah. I mean, it cost about $150 million. It made something like $350 million, so made its money back.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's just like a interesting kind of blockbuster. I don't know if it's a blockbuster, but I mean, it's an interesting, expensive movie.
Yes.
Can you think of a modern example that's like something similar? That's kind of a slow, you know, pensive movie, but it cost $150 million.
Well, and it's very episodic. That's a big, big help. And I mean, anytime you're telling a whole person's life in a movie, you know, it's going to be like Forrest Gump is super episodic. Like, I don't think that's a big budget movie that wasn't a blockbuster, you know, like they don't happen very often.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, similar things racked up the budget on Forrest Gump, but, yeah, I don't know. There aren't a lot of them.
Yeah,
I agree.
That's what I was just trying to think of another one that would even be similar.
Yeah. There are movies that are surprisingly... Like, what was that movie with Reese Witherspoon and Owen Wilson and Jack Nicholson? Like, the James L. Brooks movie from, like, last December that nobody saw. That was a $100 million movie. $100.
But that was paying off people, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Have we seen a breakdown for salaries? And Fincher probably got paid pretty well.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt. Cate Blanchett... If you want a prestige movie and you get Cate Blanchett in it.
Yeah. You know? But other than that, there's not a lot of big people in this movie.
No, and it's all the special effects.
Yeah. Taraji or Tajari P. Henson? What's her name?
However it's spelled. I would read it phonetically. I couldn't spell it for you off the top of my head.
No, I know. What is it? Taraji or Tajari?
Oh, I really don't know. Oh, okay. I really don't know.
People gave her a lot of love. Do you like her in this?
Nope.
I didn't hate her, but I didn't find her to be anything exceptional.
Yeah, it's a bad stereotype. and it's a very broad performance.
Just the black Southern kind mother woman.
Yeah. It's bad. It's okay. It's mammy.
Yeah.
And it's just, I know it's a time period thing, but it's just weird that people were giving a lot of praise for such a broad performance that is a really bad, unhealthy stereotype.
Okay. Do you like the hummingbird in this?
Nope. The only thing I like about it is that it's the only bird that flies backwards.
That's cool.
Yeah. Other than that,
I'll agree.
Doesn't do much.
But I mean, you don't like that it's in the movie. You just don't like how it looks, or
yeah, that is one of the CGI shots I don't like. Like the I've never seen a hummingbird this far out at sea. Like, and that's part of the reason I hate Brad Pitt in this movie. I hate his voice. It's really bad. There are parts where he sounds like Pepe Le Pew. It's unbelievable. the hummingbird out to sea is really bad. But the idea is that it's the only bird that flies backwards and Benjamin Button's the only person that ages backwards.
But the hummingbird's just like the feather in Forrest Gump too.
Yeah. But they lean on the feather real hard in Forrest Gump.
Yeah, they do.
There's, oh God, the feather. What? Okay. Bring up another point. I'm getting upset.
Okay. David Fincher called this his most personal movie.
That's 100% true. I think before I knew he said that just now, I think I emailed this to you.
Yeah.
It's his most explicitly personal movie. I think all of his movies are personal in a way, but I think this is the most sort of personal, like these are my emotions. And he was in the room when his dad died and he has a, he said he's been in the room with people that have been born. And I mean, he's got a kid, so I would assume that was the time. And he's sort of I think the Daisy scenes, the old Daisy scenes are very much supposed to be Fincher and his dad. And I think that's really nice. And for somebody that often gets called emotionless, like, I really don't think he's an emotionless person at all. I think he's just very, very private person. And yeah, I mean, those scenes are not things I like, that I love. And I mean, Fincher's not going to rush to do them again, but
yeah,
it's not like he's a totally cold filmmaker who never puts himself out there.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in the last one that maybe there's a bit of him and Gray Smith in Zodiac and Van Orton in
I think his personality is all over all of his movies.
Yeah, but yeah, I was going to say that this should be the most personal one because really it seems to be the most about people.
It's the most personal in sort of the most emotional way. I think you can be more personal, like as far as specific events, you know, like doing things, kind of dealing with his father's death. I mean, yeah. That's a very big emotional, personal event. But that's not to say that his whole life is less personal. You know, like there are movies, I think his auteurness is very much about his whole life and his opinion on life and how he thinks people should live their lives. And I think that as a whole is more personal than one event. It's just that this event is sort of something that is generally seen as more emotional.
Okay.
So yeah, I think it's his most explicitly emotional personal movie.
Okay. Know? I hadn't heard people call him emotionless, but I can kind of see where that comes from.
He gets sort of like a cold vibe and he's a very dry person in interviews and he's got sort of a dark sense of humor. And it's like when he was doing that interview, I think it was for Vanity Fair it was sort of like a joint interview with Rooney Mara for the girl with the dragon tattoo. And he was talking about why they didn't cast Scarlett Johansson. And the quote sort of ended up being was that, she was too sexy. Scarlett Johansson was too sexy. Like when you see her, you just can't wait for her to take her clothes off. Yeah. And, that's just something that I'm certain he meant that as a joke. That's just how he talks. And he's a very dry person. Like if you listen to one commentary, he makes a lot of jokes and he does not say it in a joking tone. He's a very sarcastic person.
Yeah. My understanding of that Scarlett Johansson quote, and this is kind of giving him a lot of a pretty long leash. I think he has a sense of humor about things. And yeah, I think he comes off pretty dry from what I've read about him. But that was kind of something just in relation to the girl with the dragon tattoo, that there is a rape scene in that movie. Mm-hmm. And Scarlett Johansson is, you know, a sex symbol. And I just think that maybe he was worried that people might get pleasure from watching a rape scene if it's someone that people are so attracted to.
Yeah.
And not that people find Rooney Mara unattractive or anything, but it's like, when you have a sex symbol and you put her in a rape scene.
And she's an established person. Rooney Mara is still the girl from The Social Network. And she'll be Elizabeth Salander after December 21st.
Yeah, I just think that, I mean, it's not that he thinks it's okay for people to enjoy Rooney Mara to be raped. But I think when it's someone who's so explicitly like a sex icon, that when people come on stage, it's like, oh, that girl's hot. I wish I could have sex with her. And then it's like a rape scene.
Yeah,
maybe he could have been more sensitive about this. Explaining that's what his point, if he didn't want people to get worried about it.
But. Well, he is, he makes jokes that, on commentary tracks that could be seen as insensitive but yeah, they're jokes. And, that's kind of his personality. And I mean, in that quote in print is awful. Yeah. It reads horribly offensive. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I think, you know, I mean, I suppose I love David Fincher. I'm never looking for a way to attack him, but listening to him talk, listening to him interviews, like he's a very sarcastic person and very dry. And yeah, I'm certain he said that in a very dry way, but I'm certain he meant it as a joke. Yeah. And I'm certain he's correct also.
Yeah, no, I agree with the sentiment too. Just, yeah, I think the context, as you said, is very important. Okay, so we just kind of touched on maybe some reasons people don't like him as a person. What criticisms do you hear of Benjamin Button specifically? Like we said, it's kind of polarizing.
Yeah, the things that are interesting about the movie, and this is going to sound really elitist, but the things that are interesting about this movie are things that weren't sold about the movie, like not the makeup and the love story were kind of what were sold. That's what was sold in.
Those are things you're not a fan of, as we've established.
Yeah. That thing I wrote about Benjamin Button this summer, it was contrasting with the romance movie that I actually love and that I love for the romance reasons. I don't know. The love story doesn't work. Well, I mean, it's not that it doesn't work. It's that it's just not focused on. And you can't be walking into a movie that you think is a love story with the way most people watch movies and then not get that love story.
Yeah.
Most people, when they don't get what they think they're getting, are disappointed and won't sort of look for another thing. And again, that sounds extremely elitist. Like, I'm better than you. I looked for more things. Blah, blah, blah. I'm a douchebag. Read my film blog. And it's hard to explain. And I don't know. Like, I certainly didn't come to this any of these conclusions about Benjamin Button the first time I saw it. I just think, in general, it is kind of an entertaining movie. And I think people will sort of generally admit that it is kind of entertaining. Like, it's not a waste of time. It's just sort of, this is not something I'd want to watch again. And I bet the visuals were a big part of me wanting to watch it again, because in 2008, that's fairly staggering stuff.
As far as the visuals, more than most people.
Yeah, and I like the Fincher visuals. And I mean, even aside from the CGI that I don't think works, the cinematography in this movie is occasionally spectacular.
Yeah,
and I think it was just sort of upon seeing it a couple times and talking about it with people, I was just sort of like, yeah, this isn't about a love story at all. And that's rarely going to be the most interesting part of a movie to me, the love story, and of any given movie. And yeah, I just sort of started to find things that I really liked. And I think it's, as far as a movie that I do not like the whole way through, and there are parts of this movie that I really don't care for at all, but it's certainly one of my favorite movies that I don't love.
Okay.
Yeah. Just because there are some things that are just done so incredibly well.
Yeah, but I think for a lot of people, I think the length of the movie has a lot to
do with
it.
That's a big part of it, yeah. And I mean, that was part of Zodiac as well. I mean, the things people didn't like about Zodiac were, one, the length, and two, that nothing really happens. As far as, like, you know, it's a serial killer movie. And,
yeah.
You see two murders in, like, the first 20 minutes, and you're pretty much dry for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I agree.
Okay.
The length never helped. Two-hour, 40-minute movie, unless it's Avatar, you know, and, like, never helps.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, we already talked about it a little bit, but I think the Forrest Gump comparison, I think a lot of people felt kind of ripped off. It's like, we already saw this movie. I think that they are different movies, and I think I like Forrest Gump more than you do, but I think I watched it a lot when I was young.
Most people like Forrest Gump more than I do.
They are very different movies, and if you've seen one, don't let that stop you from seeing the other, because, like, thematically and visually, they're very different movies.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But the list of similarities is pretty funny.
No, there is a good list of similarities, but I think the most important thing is that thematically they're totally different.
Even just, again, I like both these movies, and Benjamin Button, I say I probably like more, but you can just go to IMDb and the frequently asked questions thing. They have a good comparison, yeah. And it's pretty long. Like, even some just minor things that I didn't notice, like, they pointed out the hummingbird and the feather, and I was like, yep.
I drew that comparison first time I saw it. Even hating Forrest Gump as much as I do, I was like, that's the feather.
Yeah. It's like some poorly done, well, it's not necessarily poorly done, but like the CGI thing, and yeah, there's tons of stuff.
Yeah, and same writer, that's a big part of it.
Yeah,
because I mean,
very funny,
and that writer, that's the most notable thing that he's written and still is Forrest Gump. And it's sort of like, you know how you know, Francis Ford Coppola is going to be, you know, in brackets after his name, it's always going to say The Godfather.
Yeah,
you know, and that's how Eric Roth's career is still gone. You know, he wrote Munich. Nobody cares about Munich, and
except Seth Rogen and Knocked Up.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, no, it's just that type of thing.
Thumbs up, though.
Yeah, oh yeah. Very good movie. And then the Facebook movie, The Social Network.
Yeah.
Which people did not seem excited about initially, but...
No?
Oh, no. Not at all.
Because it was of the Facebook movie?
That's how...
Yeah.
And I mean, Fincher has talked about, like, when he tried to get Trent Reznor to do the score, he's like, hey, I'm doing this movie about Mark Zuckerberg, and do you want to do the score? And... Reznor's like, the Facebook movie, no. And it's just sort of like, and once Reznor read the script, he was like, okay, I see what you're doing here.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how people were talking about The Social Network until that trailer came out in front of Inception, the one with the choir singing Creep by Radiohead,
yeah.
And, which is still one of the best trailers that's been made in the last few years.
And it's so simple. Like, and I know simplicity can be a very good thing, especially with short trailers and stuff, but...
That's what I say about trailers. Like, the best way to sell a movie is to not give it away.
Yeah.
It kills me.
But yeah, no, it is kind of... You know, if we've been talking, it sounds boring.
Well, yeah,
and lame. And a lot of people, just in reading about it, I've been looking at message boards and stuff. And some people are like, oh, this is such a cash grab. Just because you like Facebook doesn't mean you should go see this movie. And
Well, I think if at the time of its release, had everybody that had a Facebook account went to see this movie, it would have made $6 billion.
Yeah, I saw that stat too. But I don't know. And then some people were asking like, oh, I don't have Facebook. Will I still like this movie? That's so weird to me that that was a concern for so many people. Like, I was never a cop. Doesn't mean I'm not going to like all these cop movies. Like, it seems so silly to me that the subject of a movie has to be something that you've participated in or you're not going to like it.
Cop movies have existed long before you were born. Like, you know what a cop movie is. You've known what a cop movie is for a long time. People didn't know how much the movie was going to be focusing on, like, computer shit.
Yeah.
You know? And people had no idea what the movie was really going to be about.
Yeah.
The trailer came out, I think, in that July of 2010, and the movie opened in, like, the first weekend of October. And so up until, you know, those couple months, people really didn't know anything. And I really don't think there was much of a push to let people know other things.
Yeah.
Like, it was a very, like, I don't know. It was just sort of as the reviews started rolling, people were like, okay, we should see this movie. And
yeah, it just seems like funny to me that when a movie comes out about like corporate espionage or a documentary, but like kind of a dramatized history of a company starting or like, you know, cutthroat businessmen and stuff.
Yeah.
They don't have that same problem, I feel like, yeah, the Facebook movie.
No, I agree. And it's just sort of like the Facebook movie, which is how everybody talked about it. Is sort of like, what does that mean? What is it going to look like?
Yeah.
And I think the quickest perception is like, it's going to be Zuckerberg at a computer. Yeah. And
at times it is.
Yeah. And like, how much is it going to focus on Facebook? And outside of, you know, it uses Facebook. Facebook is not the primary thing of the movie. It exists, like the movie exists because of Facebook, but it's not entirely just about Facebook.
No.
And I think people were sort of like, how is this? Like, it's about Zuckerberg more than it's about Facebook. And you can make a movie about a person really interesting. Whereas, you know, people were just like, how can you make a very simply designed website interesting?
Yeah. So what do you read much into the title of Social Network? Or did that just seem like not to call it the Facebook movie, let's call it Social Network? Or do you think there's something more to that title?
I do think there's something more. And I think it's very key that it's sort of the Social Network and not Social Network, because it's sort of, the movie is very much about, like I said, Fight Club is sort of a Generation X movie. The Social Network is very much our generation and how people our age and younger will communicate for their life, their entire lives. Like, the way people communicate has totally changed, and Facebook is the easiest way to tell a story about how communication has changed. And and I think in 10 years, it's very much going to be sort of like looking back at the 2000 to 2010, which is sort of when these things really started to change. Like, you know, you got sort of like ICQ and stuff like that towards the second half of the 90s, but Facebook really kicked down the door as far as MySpace before Facebook. But once Facebook started becoming a thing, it's sort of, I've heard Facebook as a verb so much more than I've heard, you know, MySpace me or ICQ me, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think when something that's not a verb becomes a verb, like, I think that says something.
Yeah. Because it's like that and Google, both very
exactly.
dominant things. And yeah, the use of it as a verb and it becoming part of the vernacular so quickly is something they talk about in the movie. They said, you know, within 2 weeks, Facebook me was something you could hear on campus all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it is a lot about how this movie, just showing how this product changed the way people communicate. Like Zodiac, this is very spot on selectively. Like, it was very... They looked over the depositions and everything like that.
Man. Yeah, they changed so much in this movie.
And then they changed some things. So what, I guess it's to make it more interesting, right?
Yes, yes. And to, you know, just make it a more, super, more entertaining movie. And yeah, and
make Zuckerberg look worse at times.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny, like Fincher was sort of talking about, because Zuckerberg, when he talks about this movie, seems very into saying, well, they got the clothes right. And that's kind of like his comment on the movie. Like, everything else is wrong, but the clothes are entirely correct. And, you know, he's very vocal when asked about the movie. Like, it's like, oh, it's super dramatized and I believe it. Like, what does Eduardo Saverin have to gain from saying that this is a totally fictionalized movie? Like, and he said it's totally fictionalized. Like, this is a dramatic movie, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, he probably hates, I'm can't imagine he likes Mark Zuckerberg, you know, like he owns part of Facebook again, but, you know, I can't imagine it's, you know, he's working there. Yeah. And so, I mean, if anybody wants to put the screws to Zuckerberg, and I'm, you know, I am going from my general perception of the real life thing, but mostly from the movie, but, yeah, Saverin says it's all fake basically. And so does, Moskowitz, Dustin Moskowitz. Yeah, I don't know. Very fictionalized, and I'm fine with it. And it's funny because Zuckerberg's people apparently their complaints to Fincher were mostly sort of things that they do to humanize him or try to humanize him, like him at the end of the movie adding Erica as a friend.
Yeah,
they objected to that, and it's sort of like that's probably his most human moment, maybe.
Yeah, and it's a bit sad. And one of the things I was kind of trying to get to is that a lot of it is very real, but as you said, a lot of it's fake. Or
yeah, Erica Albright doesn't exist.
Exaggerated, yeah. And so he's kind of been dating someone since he was at Harvard, and it's been like in real life, they've had a long relationship.
Yeah, before he started Facebook.
Yeah, and they're still together, it seems. So why that change in particular? And you said it's to humanize him.
Well, no, that's not the entire, like, that is a scene that I think humanizes him the most, but Erica doesn't exist specifically to humanize Zuckerberg.
Right.
I think Erica exists to drive the plot, you know, it's sort of, what does he do when Erica breaks up with him? Which, by the way, that opening scene is amazing, right?
Yeah.
You like that opening scene? And not just because it starts with Ball and Biscuit, but because it's a great scene.
And it's just so Sorkin-y.
Oh, man. It's the most Sorkin-y thing.
It's all the Sorkin-y. But yeah, my question was, like, why... Yeah, you're right. It does set everything in motion, pretty much. He kind of just seems like a bitter, you know, kind of more sensitive person who does this to get revenge on a girl, which wasn't really the case. Do you think it's kind of to do, like, it's something that you hear a lot about social networks and, you know, new technologies all the time, sometimes from older people. It's like, oh, there's so much talking, but no one's really, like, communicating, you know, that idea. Mm-hmm. Is that part of it? Like, he has all these friends on Facebook, but he's still refreshing the page to get that one more person? Is it to show that even, like, all the money and connectedness that he now has as being part of Facebook and having all these associates and having all these friends, he still feels very lonely? Is that part of it?
The second part, yeah. Second part I agree with, totally. And I disagree with something you said just before that, where you said he starts Facebook to get revenge. And I don't think he does that at all. But coming back to your second point, he starts Facebook out of revenge, but it sort of becomes him wanting acceptance from her, from Erica. And
okay.
That's why Erica's in the movie. She totally drives the movie. And yeah, if she never breaks up with him, who knows what Mark does, you know?
Yeah.
You know, movie Mark. But yeah, and then what happens the second time he sees her? He comes back and instantly is like, we need to expand. Like, this isn't impressing her yet. Because yeah. She's like, basically, fuck off.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to expand. And the very end of the movie is sort of like, well, the deposition type of stuff is over. Like, they're having a stake, and then they're coming back to the office and they'll settle it, says Rashida Jones, and playing another made-up character. But then, you know, that's all done. And what does he realize? He still doesn't have anything, any sort of acceptance from Erica, or just it's about acceptance in general, but Erica's just sort of a stand-in for that. And what he really wants is sort of just to be accepted.
So why does he push away his best friend then? It seems like he has acceptance of someone who really likes him in Spider-Man.
New Spider-Man.
New Spider-Man.
You're not accidentally making
Spider-Man
a Tobey Maguire reference.
Zodiac, yeah. Is it that, like, that's acceptance from one person, but he wants acceptance from more people and he wants acceptance from Erica?
Yeah, I think that's sort of it. It's okay. Sort of that type of thing. And Fincher is sort of, in defense of Zuckerberg, sort of said that the way he thinks that went is that so many people were just talking to Zuckerberg that Zuckerberg was so busy with, like, coding and stuff like that. It was just sort of like his advisors were like, this is the way to go. And so, yeah, I think Fincher actually kind of defends Zuckerberg a few times in the commentary track. And I think that makes sense to me. And because that's a huge epic screw over. And and I mean, movie Zuckerberg, totally I buy it. But I mean, I don't know much about Zuckerberg the person. I don't think a lot of people do. But
My understanding is that he didn't get him down to like the 0.03% or whatever it is. Yeah. It's like 7 or something. It's still, you know, mean, but not to that point.
Well, yeah, according to Severin's Wikipedia page, he's got like 5.34%.
Yeah, like, and he's back as like the co-founder on the masthead or whatever. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Mark Zuckerberg and Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah.
You like Jesse in this one?
I think this movie is spectacularly acted.
Yeah.
All through, except for one person. But JT, Justin Timberlake.
Oh, right.
I don't like Justin Timberlake in the movie. And Fincher explains his casting as sort of... and I mean, Fincher's not saying like, oh, why? Like, I hated that I casted Justin Timberlake. You know, he defends it. Or, well, he doesn't defend it because people like him. But he stands by it in that he, in casting Sean Parker, the key scene to him was not the restaurant scene where they sort of meet Saverin, where he meets Saverin and Zuckerberg.
When he's his most JT.
Well, no, it's not that discussion. It's him walking in. Like, he wanted to cast somebody that when they're walking into that room, it's not that like, it's sort of a guy walking into a place that he doesn't own that owns it. You know, like he's walking in like Sinatra, like I own the place. He wants somebody to walk in like they came up with the idea for the restaurant. They own the restaurant. They hired everybody. They know everybody.
They made all the food.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Even though he doesn't, you know, have any stake in that restaurant.
No, he has no fish or something.
Yeah. There you go. And yeah, and that's, I get that. Justin Timberlake has that.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's super charismatic. I just don't think he's a very good actor. And he's, he does a lot of actory things. Like there's that time when he figures out Facebook, like just after his introduction, where he's sort of like doing this thing with his fingers on his lips while he's thinking, and it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And there are sort of these actory things, throughout, like sort of, Fincher on the commentaries when Timberlake's making avocado, Fincher got pulled aside by Timberlake, or sorry, making guacamole, Fincher got pulled aside by Timberlake, and Timberlake's like, look, Sean Parker's allergic to peanuts. I don't know if I should do this. And it's sort of like, what? Like, come on, man. And that's why that's sort of that research that Timberlake did as well is sort of why he's got the EpiPen and the inhaler towards the end of the movie.
Right.
And it's just the sort of like actor doucheness and just the, like, I don't know. It's like you're trying so, I appreciate that he's trying so hard, but he's just not good.
Okay.
And he's too big of a star to really, some people get to a point where they're just too big of a star that they just can't. I can't buy them as an actor.
Okay.
But yeah, Eisenberg.
But back to Jesse Eisenberg. You know, no, I know.
My opinions.
I asked.
My opinions on JT the actor are now out there, and I don't have to explain it a million times anymore.
Okay. Because everyone you meet listens to this podcast.
I have this argument with Krista, who does listen to this podcast.
Hey, Krista. Yeah, I guess I understand that Jesse Eisenberg in real life had ADHD and like had to actively fight to try to suppress it a bit, and that's something that Mark Zuckerberg has too, and so he was kind of like undoing a lot of the way he's taught to act in real life, which I thought was interesting. Do you make anything of the fact that he's kind of like getting back to his roots and kind of like selling himself out in a way?
You mean sort of like the ADHD thing?
Yeah, just his personality.
I don't know.
Just some of those personality traits. Yeah. Okay.
I think that's just sort of a coincidence. Like, he was the right person for the role. And
yeah. And he does look like him. And he does nail that role.
Oh, so. He's amazing.
He's such a dick in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
I love Andrew Garfield in this movie as well.
Yeah, you said he was good before I saw this movie. And I'm going to have to go ahead and agree with you.
Yeah. And it's Social Network and Never Let Me Go, which also came out last year, which is also directed by somebody from Propaganda Films, Mark Romanek. He's very good in that as well, but he's better in The Social Network, but God, he just kills me sometimes. Like, he's a good actor dramatically. And when he gets jokes, he nails them. Like when he's really upset. And after the chicken incident, like when he feeds his chicken and he's sort of on the couch and Zuckerberg's giving him crap about it. He's like, the Marlins and the Trout. Like, yeah, it's a callback to something earlier.
Yeah. There's a lot of good laughs at this one.
Oh yeah.
Let's talk about the Winklevi too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I like them. His voice is very commanding. Armie Hammer's voice.
Yeah.
Armie Hammer, aka sexy Jason Segel.
I can see that.
Yeah, I totally see that. Because I always want, like, I've always sort of thought he was kind of weird looking. I've been trying to figure out why. And a few months ago, I was just sort of like, oh my God, he looks kind of like a sexy Jason Segel. Yeah. But anyways.
He is sexy, though.
Yeah.
Another good CGI thing, making the twins out of two non-twins.
Yeah, and I think it works extremely well in this movie.
Yeah, it just looks really good. And I didn't...
I didn't know about it until after I saw the movie.
Yeah, I didn't know that they weren't played by actual twins. Yeah. And I looked it up and I was like, wow, that was very well done. Yeah, it reminded me of like little Chris Evans in Captain America.
Yep, that's true.
Just like very, very well done.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the thing that happens, like, this is Armie Hammer's first big role. It's sort of like, if it was a note of somebody that we know, if it was actually Jason Segel, it would look kind of weird because we've seen Jason Segel. We've never seen two Jason yeah, Segels, but exactly. That it's a person we don't know, you know?
Yeah. And something we talked about several podcasts ago, which I now can say you are right about.
Oh, the CGI breath. Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking about that a couple of days ago. Yeah. It's awful.
I still stand by my point that I don't find it to be a stupid thing to do.
And that's Fincher explains it in the commentary, and that's it's basically like his explanation is it just seemed wrong to me to be in a place that was freezing cold and it was extremely cold. We just that night there just wasn't enough humidity for their breath to actually be seen, okay. So we added it in, and yeah,
it doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Did I dream this or did I read somewhere? Have you seen this that it's the same breath that Leonardo DiCaprio has in Titanic?
It's what?
It's like the same effect.
Oh, well, I mean...
But like the actual same like clip, like it would be the exact same thing that they use in Titanic.
That cannot be correct.
Is that made up?
There's no way he's using a visual effect from 1996. Yeah.
That is my best dream ever then. Yeah. AKA the lamest
dream. Yeah, that's the lamest dream ever.
You mentioned briefly about the Witch movie star line having some importance to you.
Yeah. And yeah, there's this sort of part in one of the depositions where Max Minghella's character, I forget his name, but he's sort of explaining that Zuckerberg was the star on a campus that featured
19
Nobel laureates, 15 future Pulitzer Prize winners, two Olympians, and a movie star. And the lawyer instantly is sort of like, oh, what movie star? And Max Minghella's character says, does it matter? The answer is no, but that's kind of the whole thing about Facebook is that it makes you more visible, and part of the appeal of Facebook to a lot of people is that visibility. And it's sort of, I've always sort of seen Facebook and social media for a lot of people as sort of a way to build a type of celebrity for yourself, whether it's through something viral happening or, you know, like you see tons of people just sort of tweeting to get followers and stuff like that, like Follow Friday. Like, why would you follow a random person?
Yeah.
It's for a lot of people, it's not so much about connectedness as it is about people knowing that they exist. And the lawyer at that time, other than the Winklevi, he wouldn't know any of the other people on that list except the movie star, who turned out to be Natalie Portman. And yeah, and I just think it's sort of a telling line as far as how Facebook is used. And yeah, the first time I saw that movie, that was my real takeaway from the movie, was that line.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I think that just because that's partially how I feel about social media in general.
I think that's how a lot of people feel about it.
Yeah. And I mean, I use social media, like I'm going to tweet this podcast later. I'm going to post it on my Facebook page. But I don't think everybody uses social media that way, but I think the wrong way to use it is that way.
Okay.
And what does the lawyer finding out who that movie star is, what does that add to the proceedings that are going on? It's just sort of like, this is a visible person. Ooh, who? Which yeah. visible person?
Yeah, you know? It's just about the fame thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And then what's going to happen, like, if he gets told that, it's like Natalie Portman. Oh, yeah, I liked her in Beautiful Girls. You know, like,
that's you talking.
Yeah, well, that guy was an old guy. It's possible that he saw Beautiful Girls.
Yeah. You also mentioned briefly that this kind of reverses one of the big Fincher stereotypes. Well, maybe not stereotypes, but one of his themes about the little guy or the rich guy trying to be ethical.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, it flips it in that a lot of Fincher's movies are about sort of people with means sort of finding out that their way is incorrect, or people in institutions finding out that their way doesn't totally work. And the social network sort of follows Zuckerberg more than anybody, obviously. And yeah, it's sort of like he's trying to get, like, we're watching him get rich. And we're watching him, you know, screw over people to get rich and get super rich by the end of the movie. And at the end, he is alone. He's got his money, but what else does he have? He's still looking for acceptance from actual human people. And sort of the end point of the movie is that these human aspects are what is more important than money. And you sort of think that he wouldn't care so much if he could have Erica back in his life or something, or, you know, just be more of a human, you know? Yeah, and all throughout the movie, we're just seeing that he thinks money is the way to do this, but, you know, the end is that no, it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's open as to whether or not she confirms or, you know, deletes his friend request, but, you know.
Yeah.
I think the movie is saying nah.
Yeah, I can't see it happening.
And, yeah, and, like, just sort of as he becomes an institution, Zuckerberg loses his humanity, basically. Yeah.
Okay, I can see that. Well, I can also see her accepting it later because she seems more like a forgiving person than Zuckerberg might be.
She is not happy. I don't know. She's pretty not pleased to see him.
I feel like
She's not going to get up from a table and go talk to him. Like, I don't think she's accepting
it. No, I know. But I think as time passes, she could be a bit more forgiving. But I could also see her not wanting to accept it just so it doesn't seem like she's doing it because of the money thing.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah. We touched on Aaron Sorkin, and I was going to ask what he does well, but the answer is obviously dialogue.
Yes. I think it's a really well-written movie in general. Dialogue, plot, I like all of it.
And they do jump through, you know, back and forth through the time from the deposition to the real narrative. So I guess it's edited pretty well, right? Like, it's still...
Yeah. No, I love that stuff.
It maintains your interest.
And it's sort of like Fincher, again, on the commentary, is talking about how the montage at the beginning is sort of making a face mash, or Zuckerberg's making face mash, is he was totally worried about that not cutting together. And when he did, he was like, oh, God, that's such a big relief. And, I mean, I would imagine that was sort of a worry throughout the movie with all these scenes cutting together. And I don't know. I really enjoy it. I would enjoy the way the movie cuts together. It's a very kinetic movie, and the dialogue's part of that. Yeah.
What is it about his dialogue that's good? Because I know I enjoy it, but is he just write for a dick well?
it's partially that. It's funny in a clever way, like Winklevi and bringing things back, like the Marlins and the Trout.
Yeah.
And it's very fast paced. And
he writes well for, like, witty, quick people.
Yeah, there's no space. And everybody in an Aaron Sorkin movie basically talks the same way.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I was trying to get down to, like, what is it about Aaron Sorkin? He's clearly a talented writer, and everybody points out his dialogue as being very good, but just trying to pinpoint, like, what kind of stuff it is that makes it so good.
He has a voice, and, like, a certain voice that's very uniquely his own, and all of his characters sound like him, which very often doesn't work, but his voice just is good, you know, and it just sort of works with a film style because it's very quick moving, and I mean television as well. You know, the Sorkin walk and talks, you know, like it just works for that. Whereas some writers who I love for their voice haven't written good fiction, and it's just because they have too much voice. You know, it's like every character sounds like them, and it just doesn't work in this form. Whereas maybe in a movie it would work, like it did for Sorkin. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it works. I'm excited about his HBO pilot. And I mean, I didn't love Sports Night, but I liked parts of it. The West Wing, what I've seen, is all right. But, you know, it's his style, and his style works, and I love The Social Network. So.
Did you love The Social Network more than you liked The King's Speech?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Was The Social Network the best picture of the year?
I think so. Like, I mean, I didn't do a real look of what came out in 2010, but... I think Inception, for me, is probably its only real competition, and I think Social Network in general is better than Inception, and I guess Toy Story 3 is next in line, but I definitely like Social Network better than Toy Story 3. And I think part of I wrote about this after the Oscars, is that I was, I think, arguing for the acceptance of those three movies over The King's Speech, and in 10 years, nobody's going to remember The King's Speech. In 10 years, people will remember The Social Network.
Yeah. So. Cool. Anything else to say about TSN?
Yeah, there are a lot of like more visual metaphors in this movie than there are in most Fincher movies, like the rowing thing. It's sort of like they just missed out on this thing, and
yeah.
The burning scarf, sort of like Andrew Garfield, Saverin's about to walk into getting screwed, or realizing he's gotten screwed. The lights going off after Sean Parker gets arrested at the end of the movie, the sort of end of the innocence, the lights going off in the office behind Zuckerberg. And, those things used to bother me in watching it. I've probably seen it like 5-6 times now. It doesn't bother me that much anymore. I remember I hated the scarf thing, but there's just so much good stuff in the movie that I'm cool with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Very good movie. Visually incredible. Very kinetic. Score is great.
What'd you like visually about it?
Just there's a lot of like it's a more subdued movie for Fincher, and this is partially why I'm super excited for The Girl with Dragon Tattoo, because it is not going to be subdued. but there are just still a lot of like little flares, like the rowing thing. I was looking for the name for this, but it's sort of like the way they've shot the regatta, I guess you could call it, right? Is that what it is?
It is a regatta.
It's sort of like the way that, you know, you make these real life things sort of look like macro photography, and it's just sort of like, we're seeing this race and it's this really small thing, but we're getting the close-ups of these people's faces, and it's still like, it's just super important to them. And the Facebook thing is kind of the same way. Like it's the small thing in the large scheme of things, but to these people, it's the only thing that matters.
Right.
And I enjoy that. And visually, I think that sequence is really incredible. There's that scene when right after Saverin finds out he's gotten screwed after he's talking to the lawyer, there's this shot. It focuses on a Facebook mat, right, like floor mat right out front of the office. And we see Andrew Garfield's feet, and we just do a quick pan up, or sorry, quick tilt up. And it's extremely fast, just like a Fincher camera movement. And it goes on his face, and Eduardo never breaks stride. And it's just like mat, foot, tilt up, and then immediately dollying backwards. And it's just stuff like that. And I mean, there's a bunch of shots like that. And I mean, Zodiac was a fairly simply staged movie according to Fincher. Fincher said to that point was his most simply staged movie. And there are some incredible shots in that movie, like the long tracking shot that opens the movie of out the car door is incredible and incredibly steady. The shot up from above the cab, you know, where it sort of turns with the cab, it's kind of disorienting, but it's just perfect. And when Melvin Belli arrives to something or whatever, he gets out of a car, like the camera starts and a car drives really quickly towards the camera and it stops right in front of it. And then the camera sort of like dollies out Melvin Belli, and then goes close to Melvin Belli, and then like tilts up onto him. And it's just like this incredibly elaborate shot for like just such a small thing. And
yeah.
And there's a lot of those in Social Network, not as many as in a lot of his other movies, but it's just a great movie. And the score is great. Really adds to the feel of the movie, I find.
Yeah, Trent Reznor.
And Atticus Ross.
Yeah, parts of it I didn't love it all the way through, and I should have written down which moments I didn't like it. Overall, I really think I liked it.
You probably didn't like the elephant. There's during the Sean Parker bar scene, there's an elephant in the background.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. No, I forget what it was. It was something really early on, and I was like, oh,
if
yeah.
If you say it's the piano theme.
No, whatever.
We were going to have words.
Not important.
We were going to have Sorkin-esque arguing words.
Very, very fast and clever.
Yeah. It's the only way we speak.
Did you have anything else to say about Social Network?
Nope, it's awesome. Everybody's seen this one, so.
I know, and it is good.
It's a very good movie.
Hidden check marks.
Oh, the guy, the Harvard president that they go to see is amazing.
Such a dick.
He's an amazing actor, though. That's Gary Oldman's manager, who had never acted before.
No way.
Yeah. Fincher's just friends with Gary Oldman and was just sort of like, this guy doesn't suffer fools. You know, he'd be good for this. And the studio was like, why get Gary Oldman's manager? Why not try and get Gary Oldman? And yeah. And I think that scene is hysterical. I think he's amazing. And
that's so funny.
And as far as the real life thing goes, looking at the real person's quote about that scene, he really seems like that type of person. It's amazing. He's like, well, yeah, I've been known to be short with people, and those guys coming to me or whatever, I really did not care for it, and like all this stuff. And he's just like, I was probably like that, and they probably deserved it. And like, it's just so funny.
Good for him.
Yeah. But yeah, that's... No, that was just another little tidbit.
Yeah, there's tons of funny stuff for that movie, man. I had a couple good laughs out of that.
And the kid from Jurassic Park is in it. So. So that seems like something you'd like.
Who?
Dustin is played by Joseph Mazzella. He's like the third programmer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, I remember him.
No.
Cool.
He does not like talking about Jurassic Park, by the way. Anyways,
Well, yeah, now I just kind of, now that we've kind of discussed everything,
mm-hmm.
have some very broad Finchery questions.
I love talking about David Fincher.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people respect him.
Yeah, he's an incredible director. He's never made a bad movie that he has had control over. And I still think Alien 3 is just mediocre.
Okay.
I think every other movie he's made is at least good.
Okay. My first question,
mm-hmm.
is he an auteur?
Yes.
The first
question? Oh, God, yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How so?
Well, shall we go through all of the movies?
Sure.
Because I have a point for every movie. I thought this through, and...
It is my first question on all of our auteur casts.
Yeah.
Well, all our director podcasts.
Or do you want to save this for the end, and I'll sort of go through it at the end, or do you have a good ending point? Okay, well, fair enough. All right, well, let's look at seven. Two things that Fincher... that is very key to Fincher's aesthetic is sort of a rejection of money, a rejection of commercialism, and also the failing of institutions. Sort of things like, you know, Harvard Law or the police or, you know, just these things that they have to give up. Seven, they never catch the killer. The killer wins. The cops never catch the killer. The killer surrenders. John Doe's in control of that whole movie. And the sort of these authority figures that we trust are just incorrect. Like they don't win.
Yeah.
And they don't even apprehend him. They basically do nothing. They try, but they fail throughout the whole movie. The game is pretty obvious. It's all about a rejection of money. And you know, the idea that the last shot is his first sort of free choice because he doesn't worry about his money anymore. Which, by the way, did you ever see the intro for Michael Douglas's AFI Lifetime Achievement Award?
No.
He falls.
Oh, I heard about that, though.
I watched a video of it today, and it was really funny.
Just like the end of Seven. That's hilarious.
Oh, the end of the game.
That's hilarious.
It was really funny.
Good for him.
Yeah. Fight Club, I don't even think I really have to explain this one. They destroy credit card companies, you know, like, it's Fight Club. Panic Room... Again, they sort of reject, they're like, oh, we don't need this money. We don't need to spend all the money that we have. It's just sort of like, let's live within our means. Let's get this, you know, two-bedroom place. Zodiac, again, I touched on this a lot in the discussion of the movie. It's just sort of, Graysmith is the movie's hero as much as it has one. And he is continuing because cops and journalists give up on the case.
He's just a dude.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to worry about people being like, well, it's no longer financially feasible to cover this or to, you know, try and solve this case because there aren't clues anymore.
Brian Cox.
Yeah, no, he's awesome.
I know.
And Benjamin Button is where there's the least of this, but who is the richest character in Benjamin Button?
Benjamin Button.
Benjamin Button's father. And
well, yeah, but he inherits it all anyway.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
But the person that has that money originally is a bad dad who doesn't take care of his kid, essentially. Like he gives his kid away immediately. And he's the only person that really has money in that movie. And The Social Network, I mean, it's sort of like all of these things coming to a head in that we see somebody trying to achieve this rich, to become an institution. And Facebook is an institution. Zuckerberg has become an institution.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie and he's got all the money he could possibly dream of, more than he probably dreamt of. And he's just unhappy. And I think the institutions thing is very much, about Fincher. And I mean, Fincher, the way he talks about his ad work as well, he's like, I've never been a person of commercialism. Like the commercials I do are art. And I might, you know, there are four companies and I, you know, they are, you know, it's, they are commercial in that they're commercials, but, the few commercials of his I've watched, like I showed you that Nike one with Troy Polamalu and LaDainian Tomlinson,
which is very good.
It's a very good commercial and it's really well staged. And it's sort of like, the life of, LaDainian Tomlinson, a football running back, and Troy Polamalu is a safety. It's sort of their life until they end up Polamalu tackling, LaDainian Tomlinson at the end of the video or at the end of the 1 minute commercial. And like Tomlinson is always on the left side of the screen, Polamalu always on the right, and like all through the scenes. And I like that a lot. It's a good commercial, but, and it's sort of like, he also uses these things as a testing ground. So it's like, he shot Zodiac on digital after he was like, okay, I've used this in enough commercials. I know the limits of this camera. I can trust it in a movie. And I think the big thing as far as Fincher sort of like pushing away from commercialism and particularly institutions is he never went to film school. And he doesn't believe in film school, more or less. He says, directing, and I have no source for this. This is just an IMDb quote. you don't learn directing in film school. Directing is, or directing is not sort of like about drawing and then making that picture happen. You don't know what directing is until you've got 5 hours until the light runs out. Yeah. And it's just sort of like he went to sort of a summer camp of sorts with a friend. Like a film summer camp, and everybody's doing all their like pretentious artsy stuff. And he's like, we just want to pull cables. We just want to like work on something. We want to make something happen. And I think I like that a lot about him. And going through these movies again recently, I've always sort of said that Memento has really formed my view on a certain thing in my life. And I think Fincher's movies have had much more of an effect on me than I thought until like this week.
Okay.
So I find that extremely interesting, and I love his aesthetic visually, and you know, obviously there's visual things throughout the movie, but I think he's more of an auteur than any of the other directors we've talked about.
Okay. See, I don't think that he is. I agree with your point that you can find that in all those movies. I just don't think that that's enough to make you an auteur.
Then what does make you an auteur?
Like just having a more consistent style, and not saying your movies have to be repetitive, but I just think that you have to have like a trademark on a more noticeable trademark on things. I think he does, you know, he does have some themes, and I think visually, you know, his movies are very dark and he does some things a lot. I just don't think he does enough frequently to be an auteur. And I like him tons. It's not that I don't think he's good enough to be an auteur.
Then who do you consider an auteur, and what about them makes them an auteur?
Oh, like Woody Allen or what's his name? Royal Tenenbaums.
Anderson. Okay, yeah. So it's visuals.
Not necessarily, but I mean, they have, those movies are a lot more similar to each other than his movies are to each other.
Okay.
Like I could watch.
Thematically, though, Fincher's movies are all very much, very similar.
I don't think so. I think what you brought up is correct, but I don't think that they are, enough stuff is similar. And I don't think just themes can be enough to make it. Like, you know, within 5 minutes of watching a Wes Anderson movie that you're watching a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah, because his style is very, you know, upfront.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the themes and the dialogue and a lot of the music selections and stuff like that, I think are a lot. Yeah, maybe it's more upfront, but I think that's
it's more obvious auteur-ness. I don't think that necessarily, like, I like Fincher better. I've been vocal about not particularly caring for the auteur theory in general. Because it sort of undermines the whole collaborative thing that film is, which Fincher has talked about. It's sort of like, he says it's a collaborative medium, and because it obviously is. And like, I'm not sort of just arguing to argue. I just think if Woody Allen and Wes Anderson are auteurs, I think Fincher absolutely is. It's just that Woody Allen and Wes Anderson write their movies. So they're writing about the same thing all the time. Fincher is using different writers.
Yeah.
Fincher has hired, like, he hired Andrew Kevin Walker to do a rewrite on Panic Room, and they changed Burnham from a gambler to a guy who has family issues. Sort of,
yeah.
That makes the money more of a problem for, you know, more human reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's hired rewrites, and things have changed about his movies over time that, you know, from when he gets the script, things have changed to be more into the Fincher aesthetic. I can't think of any other examples off the top of my head, but things have changed. There are a lot of rewrites and stuff that he commissions. So,
do you have a problem with his movies being long, or do you think they're all deservedly that length?
I would watch a 6-hour movie if he made a 6-hour movie.
Yeah,
because on the Aronofsky podcast, we talked about like Aronofsky's got 4 movies before I give up on watching him. Fincher's gonna die before I give up on watching Fincher. It's like, I like too many of his movies too much.
Okay. Yeah. And do you think the casting is usually on the mark?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I don't think he's never gotten a really great performance out of anybody.
Well, did he think, yeah, he got 3 people nominated.
Yep. I did not agree. I said I didn't like Taraji P. Henson's performance. I didn't like Brad Pitt's performance. And who's the third person?
Jesse Eisenberg.
Oh, yeah. No, I liked him. But yeah, I don't think he He gets great performances out of actors, but I think he's really good at casting, generally.
Okay. That's too bad for someone who does all those reshoots and all those takes to not get
well, part great of it performances. Is sort of... well, his explanation for the takes, and for those listening that don't know, Fincher tends to do a lot of takes, you know, upwards of... to a point where I think Panic Room, there's one shot where Jodie Foster had to do something like 107 times. And Fincher's whole thing, and this is partially why he uses digital as well, he's been described as a full frame director. I think Mark Ruffalo called him that, in that he's sort of watching the whole frame. And Fincher's explanation for doing all these takes is he doesn't want to have to edit around somebody screwing up. He doesn't want to have to edit around like a bump in the dolly track or somebody missing their mark, like an actor flubbing a line or something. He wants to be able to edit where every edit is for serving the story as opposed to, you know, editing around a screwy camera move.
Yeah.
And I admire that. I think that's cool. And I mean, part of the reason he went to digital is that he can watch, like dailies on a film is sort of like, you shoot the film and you can't really see with certainty what you're getting. And he always found that watching dailies, he was just super depressed because it's like, oh God, this is what we have to work with. Like, you know, you think you know what you're shooting. And then at the end of the day, you watch dailies and you're like, oh, this is what we're working with. Yeah. Whereas digital, you can watch it immediately. And so he knows what he's getting and he wants to make sure everything's perfect. And like I said, he wants to edit only where it serves the story as opposed to a screw up. And that's partially why he shoots so much. And another reason why it helps is that, like, if he gets something he doesn't like on the, you know, if he's done 40 takes and he doesn't like anybody, he's just like, yeah, delete those 40 takes. And then they can just delete it like that. And it's not really a waste. It's a usage of time. But Jake Gyllenhaal said in a thing for Zodiac that he didn't like being in a scene and be on his 50th take and then watching Fincher look them over and be like, yeah, delete those first 40 takes.
Yeah, that's gotta be frustrating.
Yeah, exactly. And but in contrast, Mark Ruffalo said that he totally respects it. It's like when you're an actor, you sort of give yourself over to a director and you just have to trust them. Right. And who should you trust more than David Fincher? You know, like
he's with his life.
His resume is incredible.
One of my questions was how consistent is he? But I think you've touched on that.
Extremely.
It's pretty good batting average at this point. What is the most Fincher-esque movie then? The most Fincherian? Most Fincherific?
It's Fight Club.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess we can't go too deep into it.
No.
Okay.
But I think, I mean, that movie is so upfront about most of what it's saying that it's pretty obvious, like, the institutions and
money. But again, that's just the thematic stuff, not the visual stuff. And
well, the visual stuff,
and sometimes it's like, sometimes with auteurs they cast the same people a lot. He does that, but not usually in the big roles. I mean, he's Brad Pitt twice, but
yeah. And I think he's used Brad Pitt three times: Benjamin Button, Fight Club, 7.
Fight Club. I was forgetting Fight Club existed for this talk.
Fair enough. Something I found interesting is that Brad Pitt is the only star actor that Fincher is reused, like in a leading role.
Yeah.
And mostly it's sort of the day players type of thing, like, you know, smaller roles. And Donald Logue or Elias Koteas or, you know, Paul Schultz, you know, people that nobody really knows, but that are in a couple of Fincher movies. And I think it's sort of like, I think the takes thing is sort of a part of that. Like, I don't think Jake Gyllenhaal is clamoring to work with Fincher again.
Yeah.
And something that David Fincher has said about Brad Pitt is that Brad Pitt is so comfortable with himself, like who he is, and they're good friends off screen and stuff like that. I think it's just sort of like, you can tell Brad Pitt to do something 1,000 times. He doesn't care. He doesn't take any offense to it. Whereas Jake Gyllenhaal clearly did take offense to these things. And it's sort of like, I think actors maybe can only deal with so much. And I mean, this isn't everybody, but you know, the rap on rap actors tends to be that they're fairly sensitive people. And I think creative people in general, Fincher is probably a fairly sensitive person, but he just does everything right that nobody really criticizes him, except for the takes thing. But and it's just sort of like some people aren't really clamoring to get that again. And just the people that only have to do 3 days of it are more okay with it. Whereas other than Brad Pitt, the people that have to do 100 days of it are not into it.
Yeah. Well, I saw a grid that had all his people that he's used on more than one movie. And it was a lot bigger because, as you said, it's not really the stars. Yeah. It's the very minor roles usually.
Yeah.
I was looking over the movies that he was offered or that he almost did, and he's got a couple superhero movies. Like, he almost did
Batman.
Batman. I guess he was in talks to do the first Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
He seems like a...
Mission Impossible 3, he left.
Oh, yeah? He seems like a good option for a superhero movie. Do you think he'd make a good one? Especially kind of the recent, kind of more serious, darker ones that...
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he would have been great at Batman. Because, I mean, what is Bruce Wayne other than sort of like a rejection of money?
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, very Fincherian things.
And yeah, doing what the institutions and stuff failed to do because they were either corrupt or just failing.
And that's why Ness, the movie that was supposed to star Matt Damon, and sort of like an Elliot Ness movie, I would have been extremely interested to see that.
Is that not happening for sure?
It hasn't been talked about since 2008. Okay. And if Dragon Tattoo's a hit, then Fincher signed on to do 2 and 3 back to back.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not happening. I would have been really interested to see that because, you know, the whole Capone thing is sort of a snafu, basically, legal snafu, right?
Yeah, my understanding, it's based on it would have been based on the graphic novel Torso, which is actually not Elliot Ness doing The Untouchables, but something else in his
career. Fair enough. Fair enough. I'm less interested, but, you know, whatever. Okay. Like I said, it doesn't matter what Fincher makes. You could remake Twilight and I'd be into it.
Okay. Mm. Activity time.
Woo!
New activity, no lightning round this time.
Okay.
It's actually just asking you some questions, but all along the same theme, so I'm going to call it an activity.
Okay.
Because who doesn't love activities?
I know I do, and I'm the only person that matters right now.
This activity is called Quotes My Goats.
Okay.
I'm going to read you some David Fincher quotes.
All right.
And you're going to tell me how you feel about them.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
First one is, my responsibility is to unsettle people.
I like it.
Okay. Do you see that
very
in a lot of the stuff he does?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I guess like probably 7 would be the most applicable one.
Yeah. And that's why I'm super excited for The Girl with Dragon Tattoo. I think we're going to get full on crazy ass Fincher. Like, I think he's coming off the social Network, which is a much bigger hit than I think Sony expected. He's been given $150 million. It's a 2-hour and 40-minute movie. It's got rape. It's got murder. Like, this is going to be the creepiest fucking movie you will see in years. And I'm so excited about it.
And Social Network was a normal movie.
Yeah.
Not to say it was average, but I mean, it was a bunch of people walking around New York, like LA and
in courtrooms. And it was still it was so energetic. Like, I think in our, we had a conversation once where I said it was, that movie was so alive that it had a pulse. And I still stand by that. But
yeah.
Girls and Dragon Tattoo is going to upset a lot of people, and I so hope it upsets me.
Okay. This one is sort of connected. His next quote is, I don't know how much movies should entertain. To me, I'm always interested in movies that scar. The thing that I love about Jaws is the fact that I've never gone swimming in the ocean again.
I like that, and I think, again, that sort of says a lot to his aesthetic. I don't think it applies to everything, obviously. But... yeah, like I said, I didn't really sleep too well for a week after the I saw 7 in a rainstorm at 2 a.m. after I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
Living in a giant apartment by myself. Like, it was just a bad idea.
Yeah.
And movies don't stick with me like that. And I think Fincher is really good at creating a sense of dread. And he sort of attributed that to, he says a lot of the people he grew up with are sort of like similar to him in that sort of got this dark sort of sense of humor. And he says he thinks... and that's kind of why I wanted to do Zodiac. And that looking back, he thinks the Zodiac, you know, the presence of an actual boogeyman in their midst sort of had a big effect on these kids. And having their school bus ushered to school by cops.
Because, he lived in San Francisco at the time all this was going down.
Yeah, exactly.
Or somewhere in California, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of Scar, like, again, Dragon Tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to mess some people up, I'm pretty sure.
So excited.
The next quote, Magot, is, I don't know anything about Academy consideration. I don't know what an awards movie is. Do you see that in his work?
Because,
I mean, obviously, Zodiac didn't get any award nominations, despite people really liking it.
Best adapted screenplay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, people wanted more for Robert Downey Jr. or maybe Best Picture, but... so there's that. Social Network did... decently with critics,
Did insanely well.
Got a nomination for Best Picture, didn't win. Yeah. But Benjamin Button kind of seems like an awards movie to me. Like, I don't think he made a lot of changes with going like, oh, the Academy will like this more, so I'll do it this way. But it seems like an awards movie.
Yeah, and I mean, when is that quote from also?
I don't know.
Yeah. Benjamin Button it really does feel like an awards movie, but I mean, I see enough of Fincher's things that he's clearly not just gunning for awards.
Yeah, you know? No, for sure.
He's not Leonardo DiCaprio in Blood Diamond.
That accent was stellar.
Mm-hmm. Or Leonardo DiCaprio in J. Edgar, or Leonardo DiCaprio in anything. I fucking hate that guy.
No, you don't. You love how he struts.
I do love the Leo strut, but who doesn't?
Okay, this quote's a bit of a long one. I have a philosophy about the two extremes of filmmaking. The first is the Kubrick way, where you're at the end of an alley in which four guys are kicking the shit out of a wino. Hopefully the audience members will know that such a scenario is morally wrong, even though it's not presented as if the viewer is the one being beaten up. It's more as if you're witnessing the event. Inversely, there's the Spielberg way, where you're dropped into the middle of the action and you're going to live through the experience vicariously. Not only through what's happening, but through the emotional flow of what people are saying. It's a much more involved style. I find myself attracted to both styles at different times, but mostly I'm interested in just presenting something and letting people decide for themselves what they want to look at.
I think that really sums up a lot of things about Fincher.
Yeah, and I know you haven't seen a lot of Kubrick stuff, but just from that description there, you find that he does more things in the Kubrick way, as he's saying?
Visually, yeah.
Like, not necessarily spoon-feeding you things, but setting things up and kind of letting you decide that this is good or bad. Not qualitatively, but morally.
Well, and I think the real thing he's saying there is that the Spielberg situations, a lot of Spielberg movies have like big action sequences that you're put right in the middle of. Yeah. Whereas we've been talking about Fincher's movies don't really.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of it. And he is placing you as an observer. And I agree with the quote. I think that sums up a lot of Finchery things.
Cool. Well, that's all the quotes my goats I have.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about more about the visual digital stuff?
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean...
is that how Dragon Tattoo is going to be?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I said, he's never going back. Because a big thing about digital is that he can put dolly track wherever he wants and get rid of it really quickly in post-production. Like, you could, with film, you sort of have a limit. It's pretty difficult, or it's significantly more difficult to remove a dolly track that's in a shot if you're using film, whereas in digital, like he edits his movies on Final Cut and does like the a lot of special effects on After Effects, which are two programs that I have on this computer right now. And I watched them take something out of The Social Network. I watched them take a track out and it took the editor like 30 seconds. So it's just sort of like, and the way that Fincher shoots with all these takes with all the reshoots he does a lot of reshoots, particularly with Zodiac and Social Network are two movies I saw that with a lot. Time is very important to Fincher. He needs as much time as possible. And also, like, the amount of light that you need for digital really helps, or really helps Fincher save time as well, because that scene in the basement in Zodiac is lit with 340-watt light bulbs, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
For a
feature film.
If you shot that scene with film, with that amount of light, like, you don't see anything.
Yeah.
And it's just those type of speed things. You don't have to adjust the lighting as much. You have to adjust it. You don't need as much of it.
Right.
And he'll never go back.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the future of Fincher?
Dragon Tattoo.
You're pumped, eh?
I am so excited for new Fincher.
More Trent Reznor, more Fincher.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just... this movie's going to be insane. And just like...
And it's so highly anticipated by so many people.
Is it? I don't know that it's going to be... I don't know.
Really?
I haven't been feeling the heat enough.
Oh, man. People are talking about it.
It better be.
Well, because it's controversial and there's boobs in the poster. And
yeah, fair enough.
Daniel Craig's there, and the book series was incredibly successful.
Yeah. And just the teaser trailer was awesome and made me really hopeful. Because it's like the full Fincher, you know? Like, I'm so excited.
Well, yeah. Do you want to talk a bit about, you want to tell the story about some of the trouble with the review that got out a little too
early? Well, yeah. I think it's David Denby, critic for The New Yorker, published a review of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and there's Sony Pictures wanted a review embargo until December 13th. Like, they didn't want any reviews being published before then. And David Denby was like, no, we have to we've got our publication date, like, we're print still. I mean, it ended up on the internet, obviously, but
yeah.
And that's where Sony Pictures took real offense. But it's sort of, his argument was sort of like, we watch all these crappy movies, and then the end of the year, you throw all the good stuff at us. And which is a statement I don't entirely agree with. But yeah, you know, people are looking forward to Dragon Tattoo, and film critics love Fincher. And so he didn't want to cover We Bought a Zoo or whatever he could see. He wanted to cover a good movie and a movie he was interested in. And so, yeah, he wrote a review. Sony Pictures didn't take kindly to it. An email exchange about it sort of got out and made Brian Grazer look like an idiot. I think that was his name. One of those. No, I don't think it was Grazer. Grazer is the crazy looking one. I forget his name.
Scott Rudin?
Scott something. Yeah, Rudin.
Maybe. Rudin?
Yeah. R-U-D-I-N.
Yeah.
And David Fincher's response to the whole thing was like, look, if I had my way, I wouldn't do any preview screenings. I'd do three on the 20th, the day before the movie came out, and then they could have their reviews in the newspaper the next day.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't care.
Well, yeah, and he took it even further. He said, if it was up to me, there would be one trailer that we run, mm-hmm. and then three commercial spots that reveal very little about what actually happens in the movie. There wouldn't be, you know, a clip from the movie that gets yeah. played on the talk shows when people are doing the publicity for it. Like, he sounds like he's in your school of thought of
yep.
minimal previews and exposure to what actually happens in the movie.
Yep. And I love that about him. You know, I like a lot of things about him as a person. And as far as his stance on how film is discussed and taken in general now. And he says the person sending a text message saying, I saw this, it sucked, or I saw this, it was awesome, is significantly more important than David Denby.
Yeah.
And that's that's how I stand. You know, like, I write some movie reviews, but I don't think they matter to anybody.
No.
And yeah, that's just kind of how.
Yeah. And he wasn't rude about the job of a film critic. He said it was important, but it's, what really matters is the word of mouth
yeah.
and people talking to their friends.
And I love that about him.
Yeah. That's a lot of things you love about him.
He's in the top three of my favorite directors, unquestionably. And if we're looking at quality, he's one or two for sure.
Ever or working right now?
Working right now, but ever. I mean, I care more about the directors I grew up with than I do Coppola.
Right.
Just part of it, because there's just more of an emotional attachment.
Good for you, Finch.
Yeah, yeah. Keep it up. Please.
Keep going forever.
Please don't die or anything. I'll be really upset.
Cool.
Yeah. I have an activity for you, I suppose.
No way.
I have written.
I never get activities.
This piece of paper, the order in which I think you like Fincher's movies the best.
Okay.
So I want you to name the order of Fincher movies, just because I was curious to see how this would work out.
I'm so bad at doing this, though. Like, so bad at ranking movies myself. Let's see. Are we counting Fight Club?
Yeah, we're counting all of his movies.
Correct.
Except Alien.
Except Alien. This is actually really hard. Okay. Social Network?
Mm-hmm.
Seven?
Mm-hmm.
Fight Club?
Mm-hmm.
I guess Panic Room's last, even though I like it. And then I guess Zodiac. What am I missing? Oh, The Game would be second last.
Mm-hmm. And then Benjamin Button between Zodiac and The Game? Or
wait. Yeah.
I was actually remarkably close.
Social Network, Fight Club, Seven, Zodiac, Benjamin, The Game, Panic Room.
You switched Fight Club and Seven. And I think that's it. I think I got this pretty accurate, huh?
I'm still split on Fight Club. I need to watch it again.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I understand that. I was just curious. I just thought the humor.
Well, yeah, that's pretty close.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Good work.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah. I was just curious. But, yeah, I guess that's not all I have to say about Fincher, but that's all I have to say about Fincher for this podcast. I'm sure in one of our podcasts, either something I'll be doing with Emily or probably Best of 2011, we'll throw down some Girl with Dragon Tattoo talk, just because I'm going to want to talk about it.
Yeah, you will.
But yeah, thank you for listening to this sprawling podcast, not unlike many of Fincher's sprawling movies. So yeah, we'll be back next week with our 50th episode. So
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by the Coalition of Cartoon Anvils. We're not nearly as violent as the media portrays us. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.